watched The War Room this morning, believe it or not. I actually went back and took another look at it. You know, always a pleasure. Yeah. Always happy to watch it. Had a pretty good time with it.
It is a fun watch, isn't it? It's kind of like...
Yeah. And, you know, James Carville, the man's a star whenever he's on screen. You know, how can you not love him?
He's a true freak.
Yeah. Yeah. I loved his fucking shirts that he was wearing.
The shirts are insane. He's like, there's, I don't know, four or five different scenes where he's eating.
Yeah.
Like at one point, he's like eating cereal in a meeting with George Stephanopoulos. At one point, he's eating a pastry while he's on like a panel discussion in front of an audience, where he's talking about like Bill Clinton's trip to Moscow, and he's like eating food.
Yeah, yeah. No, he feels like a character who's sort of like, you know, in a movie about a campaign, he would be the, you know, amusing supporting character who's been created for the movie. I mean, I guess those characters were all based off James Carville. You know, he's the Kathy Bates in Primary Colors of this movie.
Yeah, I was just watching on Criterion. They have like a D.A. Pennebaker conversation with the producers of the movie. I don't know when that was recorded, but years after the film was made. And apparently they wanted to get access to Bill Clinton. That was like the original idea.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't. And then Stephanopoulos gave them access to like the war room, and they kept filming Carville, and they didn't know who he was. They're just like, who is this absolute weirdo that loves the camera and is like the only person who's excited to always have us film? And so they were filming him, and apparently Pennebaker was like, said something to the effect of like, he's like the drunk uncle who's always like being loud at the party, and you don't want to film that guy. Like he was,
yeah.
Like, apparently Pennebaker was reluctant to like make a star out of Carville because he could tell he really was like hamming it up for the camera.
Mm-hmm.
But the producers loved it. Anyway, this is the New Yorker Political Scene podcast. I'm Russ Finkelstein. I've been hosting this podcast for, this is the 11th episode, and I have a guest with me today. Will Sloan, one of the hosts of the Michael and Us podcast, of which I am a tremendous fan.
Oh, thank you. And not just that, but we're also former classmates. I don't know if your listeners quite understand the magnitude of that.
That's true.
Yeah. We're both veterans of Columbia Graduate School of Journalism.
Yes.
So that's pretty cool.
We each flushed tens of thousands of dollars down the toilet in New York City. And I had a good time.
I loved it. No, it was fantastic. Maybe I like it more in retrospect, actually, because I remember at the time being really freaked out about like do you remember the first week we were there? One of the first assignments was we all got a beat in Harlem. And one of our first assignments was Obama had done a speech about like the jobs situation, jobs. And we had to go out and get 10 people, just people on the street, to comment on Obama's job speech and also give their phone numbers to us and their names.
Yeah.
And getting people who would match like that constellation of criteria, they saw the speech, they had an opinion on it, were willing to give their phone number to a random child. Yeah, that was really, really hard. And so like, I remember being traumatized by that day, but that's the sort of thing that over the years has become, you know, a fond memory.
Yeah. I became a huge fan of yours in that class actually, because of the way you responded to those pressures. Like, I think a lot of us just went out and sort of like forced ourselves to do things that were incredibly uncomfortable. And I'm sure you did as well, but I remember like you did one, like radio documentary where you like, it was like a profile, we were supposed to do a profile of like a business or a performance or something, and I think you went to Chuck E. Cheese,
yes,
and did like a meditation on like the animatronic band that plays at Chuck E. Cheese. I felt like it was to avoid having to talk to people, but
there may be something to that, although I did very reluctantly talk to people. You know, I did harass some families, you know, at Chuck E. Cheese on a Sunday morning in Harlem for that piece. But I think the real thing with that assignment was I was much more in love with the sound of my own voice than I was with the voices of others.
How could you not be?
Yeah. So it was less that I was frightened of talking to other people and more that I just wanted to hear myself talk.
Well, look, I also want to hear you talk. And I really mean that from the bottom of my heart. I'm a huge fan of your podcast.
Thank you.
I'm slightly ashamed to tell you that, you know, I got laid off. I was working at CNN for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. I got laid off back in, I don't know, March or April or something. But I hated that job and was kind of grateful to finally rip the Band-Aid off and have to like venture out into the real world. And when people would ask me, like, so what do you want to do now? You know, like you're a segment producer at this big news network. Like, do you want to do that? I would always say, like, you know, I know this guy named Will Sloan. And he's now forged this path where he has two different podcasts where he usually talks about like super obscure movies that don't really have like very big audiences. And he seems to be cobbling together a living doing just that. And so I'm not just a fan. I'm also like a, I'm trying to forge a path in your footsteps.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, anything I can do to help. I mean, if you might want to look at some of our other classmates who are on like Good Morning America now, or, you know, whatever they're doing, for a real, like, lucrative career. But I'll accept that compliment for sure.
Yeah. I mean, what I appreciate about it is, you know, those people, you could say they have interest and ambition that has like a broad mass appeal and is sort of like conventional in that way. Whereas you have like a sensibility that's outside the mainstream, but you've somehow been able to put one foot in front of the other. And look at you now. You're what are you, one of the most famous podcasters in Canada?
You know, I probably am, which isn't really saying all that much, but...
No, there's like four... How many podcasts are there in Canada?
Well,
a dozen?
Yeah. I mean, Canada's like any other country where there are probably 1,000 and there are probably like 5 that anybody has ever listened to. And I think I maybe crack number 5 on that list. So I do feel pretty proud of that. Yeah.
Well, I'm proud to have you. You're the first guest on this podcast whose last name is not Finkelstein, because I did have my dad on a few episodes ago. So welcome.
Thank you.
And as listeners heard at the top of the show here, we're talking today about the 1992 D.A. Pennenbaker and Chris Hegedus documentary, The War Room. Is that how you say his name? Hegedus?
I thought it was Hegedus, but I could be wrong.
Okay. Well, it's one of those two, I would be willing to wager. Anyway, this is a documentary that is shot in the Verite, cinema Verite style, sort of fly on the wall observation. And it follows the successful presidential campaign of Bill Clinton. Will, you and your co-host did an episode about The War Room a few years ago. What is your relationship to this movie? You said you just rewatched it.
Yeah.
What do you think about it?
Yeah, I'm always happy to watch The War Room again. I like this movie. I find it very enjoyable, which is, you know, not nothing considering it's set in a milieu that I hate, is full of people that I hate, perhaps even represents things that I hate. But I mean, I like Pennebaker's style very much. I think I kind of know where Pennebaker falls on these people, but he leaves, you know, a lot of room for disagreement and debate. And I think whatever else you might say about it, it's a movie that's actually fairly clear-eyed about what this campaign is and who these people are. I'm not quite sure what Pennebaker and Hegedus's conclusions are from it, but, you know, they present the evidence as it exists, and I leave it filled with nothing but contempt for these people, but feeling like I have a lot of insight into their world.
Great. Well, I think that this episode will be fun then, because for people who haven't listened before, what I do on this podcast is I listen to the New Yorker magazine's podcast, The Political Scene. Specifically, the Washington Roundtable, which is hosted by Susan Glasser, Evan Osnos, and Jane Mayer. And they have, I don't know, pretty repugnant, inside the Beltway, liberal pundit views. And They love the characters in the War Room, as you're going to hear now in their discussion. So,
and I just want to say before we go further, I am such a good podcast guest that I listened to this whole goddamn episode before talking to you, because I really wanted to bring it for you today. And, you know, I was kind of going along with it. I found it not painful for the first 10 or 15 minutes, just because, you know, this is a pretty substance-free conversation. So I can kind of, sure. I can kind of sit in here and, you know, not be wanting to tear my hair out. But then as it went on, yeah, I felt like the little frog in the boiling water just slowly dying. And there are some really repugnant things in here towards the end. So, anyway.
There definitely, yeah. No, there definitely are. And just so everyone's aware, what I said, in case you are also a potential future guest on this podcast, I did tell Will, you don't feel like you have to listen to the entire 50-minute long episode of this dog shit. I will cut a series of clips and share the transcript with you beforehand. So,
very
kudos
kind.
To Will.
Yeah,
you get a golden token that you can cash in at the time of your choosing. Don't be scared away, future potential guests, journalist friends of mine. Please still come on this podcast. I won't force you to listen to 50 minutes of New Yorker political scene. Okay, so let's get to the discussion that these people had. They did have James Carville and Paul Begala, who were both featured in this documentary. They had them on as guests. Now, as listeners of this podcast know, when I worked at CNN, I often did work with Evan Osnos and Susan Glasser, who are both contributors on CNN. Paul Begala was also a contributor on CNN. And I did deal with Carville from time to time, who would come on our show.
Wow. Hollywood Finkelstein over here. My God.
Yeah. I mean, they say it's the news is, what do they say? Or politics is Hollywood for ugly people. So,
yeah. Yeah. No kidding.
Yeah. And if they're ugly, I'm like behind the camera. So I don't know what that says about me. Anyway, here is from the beginning of the conversation between these people about the legacy of the War Room and what Carville thinks about his depiction in the movie.
For you guys, it must have been, I mean, it cemented how people see each of you. Are you glad you did the movie?
I think the 92 Clinton campaign, you can talk about how good we were. And, you know, if Paul and I would have never lived, Bill Clinton would have won the general election. Okay. That was going to happen. I mean, but the one thing the 92 campaign was, it was a significant cultural event. Mm-hmm. It was the most culturally significant campaign ever. I mean, the War Room, the Sister Soldier moment, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow.
Arsenio Hall.
Arsenio Hall.
Okay. So, yeah. I mean, there's a couple of things I find sort of like revelatory about what Carville's saying here. On the one hand, he says, if him and Begala had never lived, Bill Clinton still would have won the general election. Then what is the fucking point of this documentary?
Yeah,
right?
a little fake modesty there, I think.
Yeah, sure.
But I love a world where he never lived. I mean, God, I just love thinking about it. So that was the highlight of the episode for me. but I'm glad you picked this clip, because like this was the first clip that just made my jaw hit the floor, because it makes you realize. I've been struck a lot lately about how I think culturally deeply embedded in our society is this idea that history is this long arc of progress. And that's actually not the case. There are lots of different, you know, so many different competing narratives at any given time. Like, I would have thought that it had become basically agreed upon in, you know, liberal democratic circles that the Sister Soldier moment was not good. But James Carville is here saying, oh, God, remember the Sister Soldier moment and how great that was? I mean, God.
Yeah, they love the Sister Soldier moment in this episode on this podcast. And we're going to hear more about that. And it is really pretty wild the way the parallel they're trying to draw between the Sister Soldier moment in 1992 and what they're hoping is going to happen with the Palestinian, the pro-Palestinian activists. Mm-hmm. So we'll get to that in a bit. The other thing I think is interesting about what Carville's saying is like, yeah, we won, you know, but Bill Clinton would have won anyway. What was significant, though, is like the cultural resonance of the campaign. Like, we did such a beautiful, stunning show, you know? Like,
yeah. Well, no, he's got a point, because, I mean, when he said Arsenio Hall as like
right.
the third or fourth thing, I thought, boy, you're really reaching for a huge, I don't know. I think there are other campaigns that, you know, more bigger cultural icons associated with them than Arsenio Hall. But I mean, I sure. guess he does have a point that like he ran, like his, to him, the legacy of the campaign was like grotesque race baiting and empty spectacle. Those are the two things that this campaign pioneered and that he's very proud of.
Yeah, no, totally. And there's someone who I remember the 1992 Bill Clinton campaign, because I'm a bit older than you, Will. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like I remember Bill Clinton in the short shorts eating McDonald's. Like that exists. I think I must have been, I don't know, 9 years old or something. And I grew up in like a suburb, and I just remember like seeing Bill Clinton on the TV and being like, yeah, that looks like a guy that would be like in this, you know, upper middle class suburb. And I think the imagery or like the cultural signifiers that I remember from the campaign, one of them is McDonald's. And I think it's funny because McDonald's has really like, it occupies a different place in our culture than it did in the early 90s, when I think it was sort of like an aspirational, kind of like modern signifier, like the drive-through
yeah.
felt like an innovation or something.
Yeah, whereas now you sort of associate it with like, well, frankly, I think you associate it with like bad neighborhoods and horrible diets. And I don't know, it's just like, it's not an Americana brand anymore. It's a sort of day class A brand. I don't like that I'm saying this, by the way. That's just like ambient in the culture, I think.
Hey, that's okay. I think we might have that Morgan Spurlock documentary in part to thank for the tarnishing. May you rest in peace for the tarnishing of McDonald's good name.
Can I add one more thing about this podcast? You know, just even before these clips, when they're setting up the concept of the episode and they're saying, uh-huh. boy, you know, Kamala Harris did her first appearance in front of an electrifying crowd at, you know, in Pennsylvania, I think. And, you know, it reminded us of another electrifying moment. Of course, the 1992 campaign, right. which, of course, when I think of, you know, electrifying presidential campaigns in my lifetime, even Democratic campaigns, like that's probably not the one I would go to. But anyway, but I just love the sheer like shallowness of their conception of this, of like, hey, people were really excited in that convention hall. Kind of reminds us of another time when people were excited. And it's not even yeah. true on its own terms. He got like, what, 41% of the vote? I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
No, it is a very like phoned in, like sort of transition there. So now we're going to hear from Paul Begala. Now, the documentary is called The War Room because it mostly is centered around the group of people who are in Little Rock, Arkansas, at the campaign headquarters, sort of strategizing and responding to like news day by day. But Paul Begala was actually like on tour, as it were, with Bill Clinton around the country. So here's how he talks about his experience during the campaign.
You know, I had a totally different experience than James, because I was on the plane, the bus, I was with the candidate. And as great as the War Room was, I wouldn't have traded for a minute. If you ever get a chance to spend a year of your life sitting next to Bill Clinton on a plane, I highly recommend it.
I think there are a lot of people who have sat next to Bill Clinton on a plane who probably deeply regret the experience. Parody satire.
Yeah, it's wild to me. Like, you know, I've worked with these people, as I mentioned, and like, I don't know, Evan Osnos, I would assume, is like in his 50s. So let's just say he's like 10 years older than me. I wouldn't normally feel like that's that much older. But the fact that they could sit there and hear someone talk about like sitting on an air, how incredible it is to sit next to Bill Clinton on an airplane and not have it register in their minds, like, damn, that's going to really remind a lot of people of like a very nefarious part of Bill Clinton's past. Like it doesn't seem to occur to any of them.
This does remind me of, I feel like there was a very long period when there was a huge campaign to convince everyone that Bill Clinton, like sort of during the George W. Bush era, like Bill Clinton, he's the smartest guy. He's also the coolest guy. He's the most affable guy. And I think this really sort of hit its peak sometime around the 2012 DNC when he gave that, you know, huge long speech. That was probably when his brand, his post-presidential brand kind of was at its pinnacle. And I don't know what to say except that the thought of being on, you know, let's say I was not like a small child being sex trafficked. Let's say I was, you know, a full grown man. Even then, the thought of being on a plane with Bill Clinton, hearing him talk about like sensible solutions in a folksy twang. I don't know. It's just an awful thought. I would like anything but that
for an entire year. That
God. Yeah.
No. Yeah, it sounds awful. It's also worth mentioning here, I don't know when they recorded this episode, but Donald Trump recently flew. Did you see this? He flew on a jet, a chartered plane that had previously belonged to Jeffrey Epstein.
I mean, and like some people. That's great. It's like just recycling, you know, waste not, want not. I think that's fantastic. I think what was great about that particular news item was, it was also pointed out it was not the Lolita Express. It was that plane has been destroyed apparently. It was another plane bought in 2017, which Ross, you'll recall, was after his prison sentence. So he had Epstein had served his debt to society. So it all seems above board to me.
What are we to do? We're supposed to just destroy like every item that this man ever touched. Like these are this is a perfectly good airplane.
Amen.
There's a perfectly good sex dungeons, you know.
Yeah.
Like I don't know why they have to go to waste.
Yeah. No.
Just because bad things might have taken place there.
Amen.
All right. Well, moving right along here, we're talking now about the 2024 presidential race and specifically the Harris-Walz campaign. So Paul Begala is talking about parallels he sees between the 1992 Clinton race and the current Harris race.
This is going to be painful, folks. This is a tough one.
There's going to be a test of strength. There are going to be protesters there. And I checked the uncommitted anti-Israel folks have 30 delegates. There's 4,600 delegates. And they want two speakers. Okay, which is if every 30 delegates gets two speakers, it'd be 308. it's preposterous. And we honor that they got 30 delegates, but they get the power of 30 delegates. And I for one, want to see strength. Keep in mind, you know, Bill Clinton gave the Sister Soldier speech. And he did it because an artist, not in her art, had called for killing people because of the color of their skin. That's what she said. She said it during those riots. And Clinton said, that's simply wrong. And it showed people that he could stand up to extreme elements, even in his own coalition. Trump can't, right? He embraces them. Stand back and stand by. He says to the Proud Boys. Okay. And so I want to see what will happen when, and they will come, the protesters come. It happened in Detroit. And I thought the vice president handled it masterfully.
He thought she handled the protesters in Detroit masterfully. That was the first time that she responded to these protesters, where she said to them, I'm speaking. And in fact, as the campaign progressed and she made future appearances, she sort of toned it back because I think the Harris campaign recognized that that was a mistake, like to be as aggressive as she was. But what do you think about what Begala is saying here?
Well, I think it's interesting just because he's a kind of like unreconstructed ghoul. You know, I looked it up, and of course he's on like the board of Democratic Majority for Israel. You know, he's pretty deeply invested in this. I mean, I can say the obvious thing, which is that to compare like the pro-Palestinian protesters to the Proud Boys and draw a direct equivalence to them is pretty grotesque. Also kind of amazing that, like, yeah, like, just as this unreconstructed ghoul, he looks at the Sister Soldier moment and he's like, ah, yes, you see, that was how you handle it. That's the way to do it. And like, listening to this whole thing, it's just kind of amazing, like, these two guys, Carville and Begala, keep being positioned on this podcast by the hosts as, like, you know, these are guys from an earlier era, and because, you know, they don't have any interest to serve anymore, they can just come on here and they can speak truth to power. They can say whatever they need to say. And of course, what that ends up being is, like, we got to go back to the Sister Soldier strategy for these, like, goddamn anti-Semites out there, you know?
Yeah.
That's the speaking truth to power.
The thing I find interesting about his take on the Palestine protesters and also the Sister Soldier moment is, like, him and Carville both seem really invested in, like, the revanchism of it, like, in the sort of, like, smacking these people down,
yeah,
and, like, putting them in their place and really, like, showing them who's boss and not letting them move you one inch on your position. And in fact, like, feeling like they and the campaign should be rewarded for that, you know, for that sort of, like, taking to task of people within their own alliance or whatever.
Yeah, totally. And which is interesting too, because there are a couple of times in the discussion where they sort of, like, posture as small d Democrats, like when they're talking, yeah, about Biden stepping down. They talk a lot about, well, they talk about it almost in terms of, like, giving consumers value for their money. Like, well, 75% of people say they didn't like this ticket, so you'd be ridiculous to not give them what they wanted. You know, obviously, to say nothing of the super majority of Democratic voters who are appalled with what's happening in Gaza right now. You know, their commitment to small d democratic principles is obviously very malleable and site specific.
Yeah, and even if they are, like, in my perspective, and I'm sure yours, like, on the wrong side of the issue when it comes to Israel and these protesters who have every right and, in fact, like, should be shouting their protests until they're listened to, until the campaigns do take up the mantle of their cause. Mm-hmm. And the more that position they take on, I think the better they'll even fare in the election. But putting that aside for a moment, I did cut the Sister Soldier speech that Bill Clinton gave in 1992 because, like, what I think is interesting is a lot of people remember that speech either as being, like, kind of bad and reactionary and an example of how to, like, alienate people who could otherwise be engaged members of your base, or, if you're Paul Begala and James Carville, this instructive lesson in, like, how to swat down, like, uppity members of your coalition. Mm-hmm. But Bill Clinton, I think, actually was kind of artful in the way that he conceded certain issues and said, like, look, you know, I support her right to sing and make music. And, like, I admit that I've made mistakes, and I'll play the clip because I think it's probably a lot more compelling and convincing than it is, like, the way that Harris, for example, handled the protesters in Michigan.
You had a rap singer here last night named Sister Soldier. I defend her right to express herself through music. But her comments before and after Los Angeles were filled with the kind of hatred that you do not honor today and tonight. Just listen to this, what she said. She told the Washington Post about a month ago, and I quote, if black people kill black people every day, why not have a week and kill white people? So you're a gang member and you'd normally kill somebody, why not kill a white person? Last year, she said, you can't call me or any black person anywhere in the world a racist. We don't have the power to do to white people what white people have done to us. And even if we did, we don't have that low-down, dirty nature. If there are any good white people, I haven't met them. Where are they? Right here in this room. That's where they are. I know she is a young person, but she has a big influence on a lot of people. And when people say that, if you took the words white and black and you reversed them, you might think David Duke was giving that speech. Let me tell you, we all make mistakes, and sometimes we're not as sensitive as we ought to be. And we have an obligation, all of us, to call attention to prejudice wherever we see it. A few months ago, I made a mistake. I joined a friend of mine, and I played golf at a country club that didn't have any African-American members. I was criticized for doing it. You know what? I was rightly criticized for doing it. I made a mistake, and I said I would never do that again. And I think all of us have got to be sensitive to that. We can't get anywhere in this country pointing the finger at one another across racial lines. If we do that, we're dead, and they will beat us.
Okay, so there is some kind of ridiculous, things.
When he's quoting her, I'm just like hooting and hollering. It's like, that's awesome. I love her quotes. And then when
Good questions, totally valid questions, honestly.
Yeah, and then when he follows it up with, but hey, we all make mistakes. I mean, when I went to the mansion from Sallow, I found out that it was actually whites only, and whoops, I'm not going to do that again.
Yeah, no, it is ridiculous. But do you see my point? It's like,
yeah,
just in terms of like interpersonal relationships, mm-hmm. It's such a different approach to say like,
totally.
I shouldn't have gone to the racist whites only country club. That was a mistake. And that not embracing each other in this fight is gonna cost us all, and we all need to be together, whatever. At least there's like he's trying to wrap it up neatly and make it feel like we're all part of the same team, instead of the way Harris handled the protesters in Detroit by simply saying like, if you want Donald Trump to win, keep saying that.
Yeah.
And if not,
yeah.
I'm talking.
I mean, you know? The way that Harris has been shifting rhetorically the last couple of weeks has been interesting. Like, she's obviously, like, the first way, that first appearance in Detroit where she said, I'm speaking, is obviously, like, really cynically wielding the kind of, like, you're going to interrupt while a woman's talking, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And now she's falling back on the sort of classic Democrat, like, you know, I see you, I hear you, I feel you, you know, we're all bearing witness to the suffering, and somebody's really got to speak out about this. And I don't know. I'm really curious how long this is going to sustain her. I mean, like, I would be shocked if she doesn't win the election, but it does feel like she's kind of coasting on a lot of fumes, and this Gaza thing. I mean, I don't know if a supermajority of voters, it would be like a deciding thing for them, but like, it's a headache that's not going to go away. And I don't think these strategies are enough yet.
Well, the Democratic National Convention is going on this week.
Mm-hmm.
And I do know that the Uncommitted National Movement, they have 30 delegates at the convention. And I do know that there are some protests planned either outside the convention hall, and who knows, maybe there will be disruptions from the convention floor. And that could be, you know, the sort of thorn in the side of the organizers of the convention, who hope that it just feels like a big love fest and a unity rally, the way the Republicans had, like a very galvanizing convention. So yeah, maybe the honeymoon period of the Harris campaign could be over this week if like she doesn't do a good enough job handling this issue.
Yeah, but who knows? A lot of people seem to be pretty happy if all she says is something like, we acknowledge that there's a horrible humanitarian crisis in Gaza, and we're doing everything we can, and I won't stop speaking about it. You know, a lot of people seem sated by a statement as superficial as that. I hope I'm wrong, you know.
I think you might be right, but what I think will have an impact on how the issue is thought of is how the the leaders of this uncommitted movement respond to that? Because I don't think they're going to be satiated by those sorts of talking points. They have very specific demands, and one of them is a discontinuation of U.S. arms to Israel. So yeah. I think if she doesn't say that, they're going to keep making hay about it, and whatever, she'll respond however she responds, and then that will be the story.
Yeah.
And Paul Begala has some advice for her. Let's listen to what that advice is.
I don't know if she has. I want to see Kamala Harris go on Charlemagne the God.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because it's another, he's sort of the inheritor, maybe, of that kind of cultural political role.
I love this clip because, first of all, it's just funny that Paul Begala sort of considers himself like an arbiter of what is or isn't the inheritor of the space left by Arsenio Hall. But second of all, it's clear that he doesn't actually watch The Breakfast Club, which is the show that Charlemagne the God hosts, that Kamala Harris did go on in 2019.
I remember that well. She was very good on that. Yeah.
Have you ever smoked?
I have.
Okay.
Like in college, I inhaled. I did inhale.
Okay.
It was a long time ago. But yes.
I know you have to go. They say you have to go. I just
broke loose.
I mean, was it in college? See, I like stuff like that. That's a real honest answer.
Real.
Was it a blunt or joint?
It was a joint.
Hey.
Yeah.
You remember the high?
I do.
So if it was legalized all throughout the country and medicinal, would you, you know, do it?
Listen, again? I think that it gives a lot of people joy, and we need more joy.
We need more joy in this world.
Another myth is that, I don't know if it's a myth, but they say you took campaign donations from big banks.
No. No, I have not taken from corporations and big banks. I don't believe that I have.
She hasn't done any interviews since, you know, being endorsed by, since Joe Biden dropped out and he endorsed her. So, like, I don't know if he meant he says, like, I don't know if she has gone on Charlemagne the God. Well, Charlemagne the God is a host of a show. It's not the name of the show. And second of all, she did go on in 2019. And third of all, did he mean maybe hasn't gone on, like, since she became a candidate for 2024? She hasn't gone on because she hasn't done any interviews. So,
you know, seeing
it's just
her,
funny. He's like making this suggestion, but it's clear he has no idea what the fuck he's talking about. He just thinks she should like do more black people.
Yeah, he's thinking. Yeah, the first black person I can think of. Yeah. You know, seeing her in Detroit, you know, during that really unpleasant interaction with the protesters, I was reminded, like, after a couple of weeks of just breathless excitement around her, like, oh yeah, I forgot she's like really not a very good politician,
right,
which, hey, maybe enough to beat Trump, I don't know, but yeah, it just kind of reminded me of the old friend that we all got to know back in 2019.
Yeah, it's amazing that everyone seems to have completely forgotten that whole chapter of history. But as someone, I'm sure books are already being written about how 2020 has been completely memory holed
yeah,
in lots of senses. All right, well, let's move on to the next icky discussion here. This time, Jane Mayer has some questions about recent comments that James Carville has made about, I guess you could say, women and politics.
Can I ask you guys about gender politics for a minute? James, you sort of jumped into this thing on the preachy females ruining the Democrats' message. Yeah. And we're now looking at what's got to be the most anti-female campaign we've seen in a long time coming from the Republicans. I'm wondering, you know, which is harder and more important, for the Democrats to win over the men or for the Republicans to try to get some women in their column? How do you see this thing playing out?
Well, first of all, there are too many preachy females in Democratic campaign culture. All right. And what I mean, that they're sometimes unrelatable to people around the country. And, you know, if you say something, you got to say something that sticks. OK, I could have said Democratic campaign culture is overly feminized. All right. But
I don't know, James, you're going to be, there's a large segment of our listenership and not only of the female persuasion that is going to freak out
about
this.
I understand, but I view myself as a kind of provocateur.
Okay, so what they're referring to here is a column in Maureen Dowd's, an interview that James Carville gave to Maureen Dowd that was published in her New York Times column, where he said, quote, "A suspicion of mine is that there are too many preachy females dominating the culture of his party, of the Democratic Party. Quote, don't drink beer, don't watch football, don't eat hamburgers. This is not good for you. The message is too feminine. Everything you're doing is destroying the planet. You've got to eat your peas."
If true, if that's the message they're running on, I agree with Carville that the Democrats are going to lose. I think a message of don't drink beer and don't watch football would be political suicide. I guess is he referring to the squad, basically? Is that what he's dog whistling about?
I think he's referring to the squad and then maybe just like political activists and organizers, maybe, you know, Hollywood people who like the Alyssa Milanos of it all. Maybe that was sort of what he was referring to.
Right. I mean, as long as you're being preachy about things that people really care about, like violent rap music or the state of Israel or, you know, other, you know, kitchen table issues. But not what they're talking about. Yeah.
No, not these uppity women with their their preaching. The thing that's wild to me is it's clear that Jane Mayer like has a lot of respect and admiration for James Carville. So instead of just asking him a question, like, you said something that got a lot of criticism and I think was pretty sexist and disgusting. Here's what you said. Why did you say that? Right? That's the way like she might have handled the same question if she was talking to like Steve Bannon or something. Instead, she repeats back the gist of what he said. And then the question is, what's a bigger challenge? Getting men to vote for Democrats or getting women to vote for Republicans? And you're like, why are you like entertaining this disgusting, reprehensible, like 1950s bullshit with
also,
this guy?
Also, like, there's a large segment of our listenership that's going to freak out about this. You know, the kind of offloading of the offense onto some, you know, invisible constituency. Like, I don't know. Like, can't like the panel be offended by this? Why do they always have to speak about some? You know, why do they always have to say, well, hey, you can say that here among friends, but there are some screechy women who are probably listening right now. What would you say to them?
Yeah, I mean, the answer, I think, is that because they're all chummy with each other, which is, you know, you guys on Michael and Us have like the end of history as a concept that you always go back to. Mm-hmm. I'd say like this podcast is starting to develop this sort of like, it's a small club and you're not in it sort of idea where it's like, the reason why she doesn't go at him for this is because they all live in D.C. and she likes them. And they say at the end of the podcast, like, we're so grateful to have you help us make sense of this crazy world we're living in. And it's like, really?
Yeah.
Like, this is the sort of hogwash that you guys are so grateful to have?
You know, James Carville, it's like, goddamn, you know, you win one election 30 years ago with 42% of the vote. And, you know, thanks to there being a movie that was made about you, we're just stuck with him forever.
It's really something.
I should mention, by the way, about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, I was reading Tucker Carlson put out a book of his journalism. You may not remember this, but before he was the Tucker Carlson we know today, he tried to be a sort of Tom Wolfe type figure, you know, a sort of vaguely right-wing journalistic wit, and he put together a book, probably about half of which is kind of good, you know, because he was good as a writer when he was writing pieces about people like James Carville, and he wrote this absolute sort of hatchet piece about Carville, and in the introduction to the piece, written in like 2022 or whatever, he said something like, oh, yeah, this was a great piece to write. By the way, Carville is one of my closest friends, and I've never made a major life decision without first consulting him. You know, which is amazing, but then it's also not at all amazing. Like, Carville probably read that piece and thought, "Heh, boy, he sure got me." And, you know, they went out for a drink after because it's all play acting.
Well, yeah, it's actually like another interesting aspect of the documentary is James Carville's wife is also in the film, mm-hmm. and she works for the George H.W. Bush campaign.
Right.
So she's a Republican strategist, and you see moments where like he's in the war room and he's talking on the phone to her, or they sort of like brush up against each other like at different events that both of the campaigns are at. And yeah, like he's asked at some point by a journalist about it, and he's like, "Well, you know, my marriage is my marriage, and we don't see eye to eye on politics, but at the end of the day, we go home together." I think at the time they were dating, and then they got married afterwards. But I think, you know, it's just like sports for him. All right, we got a couple more clips here. Here's another one where Susan Glasser is trying to basically make draw a parallel between the 1992 Clinton campaign and the 2024 Kamala Harris campaign.
"We won't go back. We won't go back" is the signature chant of the new Harris campaign. It was not the signature chant and was not really available to the Biden campaign. But "We won't go back" is the modern version of that 1992 "Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow." Harris has gotten not only her own messaging, but that of her crowds is about owning the future lane, owning the tomorrow lane, being the change candidate. And I think when you look back at that war room movie, that's the lesson. That's the message.
Yeah.
Is that the lesson and the message from the war room movie, Will? Stop thinking about tomorrow.
Yeah, I don't think it was the lesson of the movie, but I'm going to qualify that by saying, like, even more than the War Room movie, the thing I most think about and refer to about the movie is the trailer, where the trailer said, you know, the narrator voice said, it's a look into the first president from the rock and roll generation. And mm-hmm. one of the things that Carville says on this podcast that I think actually has a little bit of insight is he says that Clinton was the first president to not have any connection to World War II, you know, to not have been a veteran, or the first president of that era to be born after World War II. And you know, I think to the extent that there's a parallel between his campaign, maybe it isn't a parallel, but like obviously some of the energy that Clinton was trying to tap into was this idea of like, you know, this ambient feeling of the wall is down, it's the end of history, and we need a younger president who's more in tune with this like post-political era that we're in. You know, somebody who isn't hung up on any of the old dogmas of the past. Somebody who, you know, is of the now. So I think the movie sort of captures that a little bit. I mean, the movie is largely free of ideology, I would say, but it does capture like the construction of that candidate and the, you know, conveying of that message. I think Kamala Harris's political moment is different in a million large and small ways. And, you know, to the extent that I don't think they're similar at all.
Yeah, I think so. Just if we're comparing the two slogans, which I think is sort of an interesting exercise, you got "Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow," which is very like it's like an open ended prompt, right? Like, the tomorrow could be in theory like anything you want it to be. Like, you fill in the blank and sort of choose your own adventure in terms of what tomorrow holds. Now, "We won't go back." Is that what it is? Or "We're not going back"
something along those lines. Yeah.
Like, now to me in the year 2024, I can't help but think of that idea in the context of the repeal of Roe. And the repealing of like abortion rights in large swaths of the country. And "not going back" to me seems to be like a rallying cry about not going backwards into like the way that America used to be before all sorts of progress was made, mainly on women's rights issues, but I would assume also on race and other things that, you know, we've made some degree of progress on in the last, I don't know, 100 years.
Right.
To me, it's actually not the same as saying, don't stop thinking about tomorrow, because in a way it's less hopeful. It's like, we're not going back. It's like, okay, like, what about the what about in front of us? Like, what are we saying about what's in front of us? We're just saying, I don't want to go backwards. And also, by the way, like, part of the critique I have of that slogan is Joe Biden, to his credit, before he dropped out of the race, did lay out a plan regarding the Supreme Court. It was like term limits and a bunch of other stuff that would probably balance out the court and hopefully eventually reinstate abortion rights for women in the United States. Mm-hmm. But as of yet, I mean, maybe by the time listeners are hearing this, they'll have laid out their plan to establish abortion rights nationally. But besides saying you don't want to go back, like, we already sort of went back a bit on that issue. Mm-hmm. I guess, yeah, it just feels to me like don't go back. It's reminding me too much of the bad things that have happened.
No, you're right. You're right. But I mean, I guess that is kind of the campaign strategy, isn't it? I mean, so far,
yes.
As many have pointed out, there's no policy page on her website. So far, they seem to be running as much of a vibes-based campaign as possible. And so, like, in its way, it's an effective slogan because, like, if you look at it from one angle, you can kind of trick yourself into thinking it's about the future. But what it really is, yeah, it's a slogan that's kind of in line with what she said in Detroit. Like, do you want Trump to be president again, you know?
Then if not, then do this. Right. Shut up and come with me. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite scenes in the film is what I think like is the point of the movie, or I don't know, you were sort of hinting at this maybe, that Penn and Baker might not think of Carville and Bagala and Stephanopoulos as these like righteous heroes. So there's a scene that's like towards the end of the film where Stephanopoulos is like talking, he's speaking to someone on the phone. Someone calls and says like, we have someone who's calling for an off the record conversation from, I think he says like the Illinois parole office. And all you hear is Stephanopoulos's side of the conversation. And he says something like, if you went on the radio and said Bill Clinton is the father of an illegitimate black child, you would be laughed at. Everyone would think you were crazy. First, it's not going to matter. Number two, think of yourselves. I guarantee if you do this, you'll never work in Democratic politics again. You'll be embarrassed before the National Press Corps. No one will believe you, and everyone will think you're scum. Or you'll do the right thing, and you'll have a campaign that knows you did what was right. We can't do anything specific for you or anything, but you'll know you did the right thing, and you won't dishonor yourself. And it seems like he's threatening a Bill Clinton accuser in the lead up to the election, and sort of threatens this person and says, if you go forward with publicizing whatever it is that you claim happened, we will destroy your life.
Yeah.
And that's also how the film begins, with Flowers.
Yeah, Jennifer Flowers. And I love at the beginning of the movie where you hear like the recorded phone call between her and Bill Clinton, where he's like, well, you know, you've destroyed all the evidence, right? He doesn't say those exact words, but he might as well. And then right. It cuts to Bill Clinton talking to reporters like, no, play the tape back. If you'll hear, I said specifically in the call, there is no evidence. So what do you want? It's fine. I mean, it's actually kind of amazing to me that like the stars of the movie, Carville especially, are basically like okay with the movie. And in fact, I think on the Criterion Blu-ray of it, there's footage from a Q&A at some screening that Bill Clinton actually took part in. So Bill Clinton gives the movie his implicit endorsement as well, despite everything that happens in it. And I think that's what the movie's interesting ambiguity, which is that it shows all this stuff. And the people, you know, Pennebaker and Hegedus's attitude may very well be, it may be these people are monsters, these people are scum, but it may also be, gotta hand it to them, you know? They roll up their sleeves and get it done, which I think...
If you go to war, yeah, there might be some casualties.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Hegedus and Pennebaker leave a lot of room for you, the viewer, to decide what you think of that. But I think an overwhelming sense that you get from the movie is that these guys are extremely effective at what they do, whether you like it or not. And that's why kind of everybody on screen, everybody involved in the movie basically endorses it.
Yeah. I love towards the end of the film, there's like this very famous speech, right, where Carvel sort of talks about like what the campaign has meant to him personally.
We made history tonight. Yeah.
Yeah. And he like basically like starts to cry basically and gets all weepy and says, I'm happy for all of you that you're a part of this very important moment and blah, 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 blah. But my favorite lines are, he says, there's a simple doctrine outside of a person's love. The most sacred thing that they can give is their labor. And somehow or another, along the way, we tend to forget that. And labor is a very precious thing that you have. And any time that you can combine labor with love, you've made a merger. Which I love, because it's like, you think you're reading Karl Marx or something for like the first like three sentences. You're like, damn, this guy's like all about like the workers and like recognizing the power of your labor and stuff like that. That's kind of unexpected. And then, if you can combine labor with love, guess what? You've made a merger.
That's right.
I have one last clip here. This might be a prompt for a suggestion, Will, for you and Luke Savage over on the Michael and Us podcast. Let's hear James Carville talking about a project he's got in the works now.
There's a new film coming out about me that's going to open in a film festival in Western Colorado. I can't say the name of it. But more importantly, we've just accepted an invitation to the Middleburg Film Festival.
Ooh.
All right.
Right here in the neighborhood.
Right here in the neighborhood. And I think Maureen Arthur and Luca Russell are going to interview us after the showing of the film. So it'll be sure that y'all all invited to it.
I got to say, we got a little sneak peek, those of us at the Political Scene podcast. It's fantastic. It is so great. And you guys, I mean, you only look maybe a day older from after those early years.
For political junkies, talking to you two is like talking to like Brando and Pacino about The Godfather. It's a little, you know, it's nice to see you guys going strong. And we're looking forward to the new movie. Well,
absolutely. Congratulations. And thank you for continuing to shape how we think about campaigns. This has been a hell of a campaign for the record books. And I think we're all grateful to both of you for helping us to understand what the hell is going on.
What do we got to do for the Michael and S episode where you guys review the new James Carville documentary?
Boy, so Carville seems to be indicating that it's going to premiere at Sundance. That's very exciting. I would love nothing more than to fly to Colorado in like the 0-degree weather and just, you know, take in a goddamn James Carville documentary, hagiography, fucking puff piece. That would be great. But that clip, incredible. Just the sheer unabashed, like, blow jobbery of the interviewers at that moment. Like,
yeah.
this is not how they taught us at journalism school, that you're supposed to deal with your interview subjects. I mean, this is grotesque.
Yeah. Especially ones who are like overtly publicly ideological. The whole point of James Carville and Paul Begala is they are partisans. That's their whole fucking thing, you know? You would hope that some political writers from The New Yorker would have enough distance from their subjects to not just be like falling all over themselves to tell them how much they admire and appreciate their insights.
Yeah, talking to you guys is like talking to Brando and Pacino about The Godfather. I mean, I guess that's true. if The Godfather was like, you know, something horrible and the guys in it were even worse, it's a direct comparison. Yeah. It was fun listening to this episode because it kind of feels like, you know, visiting some forsaken island that was left behind by civilization, or like stumbling on the planet where Matt Damon lives in Interstellar, because I feel like discourse has moved past everything that's represented in this episode. Like,
yeah,
like this is a throwback to a time when politics was something that people paid attention to every 4 years, and like there was, you know, it was treated like sports, and you know, like I feel like whenever I see anything from The New Yorker that's political go viral, it's like those Isaac Chotiner interviews or something like that.
Yeah,
something,
which are amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
By and large.
Yeah, something that has a little bit more meat on its bones and blood in its veins. I mean, this podcast where it's these really chummy DC people who don't believe in anything in particular talking to James Carville about, remember the Sister Soldier moment, and remember Arsenio Hall. Like, this is the kind of podcast that people, you know, people who really care about politics would get angry about if only they stumbled upon it. And why would they, you know?
Yeah, if I wasn't here to rub everyone's nose in it, then maybe, you know, it could just exist. And
thank you. You're doing a service. You know, we all have things like this, these forgotten corners of the internet that we're fascinated by, that we'd like to rub into people's noses. And I'm glad you're doing it.
Well, I appreciate it. I take up the mantle of the yellow journalism made popular by the founder of our school, the Joseph Pulitzer himself.
Hell yeah.
Who thought, you know, if you don't splash like a horrific crime scene image on the front page of a newspaper, is anyone going to care or pay attention?
But before you go, I want to trade one more old journalism school memory with you. Do you remember a guy named Richard Wald, who was...
I do remember Richard Wald,
Yeah, I loved Richard Wald, and I had a few classes with him. And I remember at the end, he used to bring Henry Kissinger to school every year until I think somebody threatened Dr. Kissinger, and he stopped coming. But Richard Wald, for anybody who doesn't know, and why would you know, he I think was the former head of CBS News, NBC News, you know, one of the big three, their news division. And I remember on the last day of national affairs reporting class, I think it was, he delivered this exquisitely delivered monologue where he was like, if you leave here and you become just a journeyman reporter, don't talk to me. Don't contact me. I don't want to know you. Make yourself extraordinary. And that's the kind of like monologue that gets lodged in your head like a silver bullet when you're, you know, 22 years old or something at the Columbia Journalism School. And I do wonder, you know, what is James Carville extraordinary to Richard Wald? You know, I'm just curious
sure
what his definition would be. Yeah.
I would be willing to wager that he is.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again, Will.
Ross, I'm always happy to chat. You know, we'll have to hang out next time I'm in New York.
Yes, let's do that. And everyone subscribe to Michael and Us. And what's it called? The Very Important Cinema Podcast.
Merely the Important Cinema Club.
Ah, the important, yeah. That truth be told, I'm not myself a subscriber to that one. But.
I like your honesty. You know, you take the ethics.
But I like that you
seriously.
Do it.
Yes, thank you.
I like that you're doing it, and I know more or less the gist of it. And yeah, glad you're out there existing in the world. You know.
Likewise.
As an exception to the rule of, you know, not being able to make a living doing something you think is good.
Thank you. We'll see how long it lasts.
And finally, I want to thank the members of my brilliant, aggressive, unconventional, but always winning campaign staff.